I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The murder in June of Pakistani internet celebrity Kandil Baloch was just one example of a so-called honor killing, but 5,000 of them occur around the world every year. Today, meet an attorney who's working to help victims of gender-based violence find asylum. Then, a look at two new tax proposals that voters will decide on in November. One would fund construction of a new courthouse in Johnson County. The other aims at financing light rail in KCMO. Later, we'll bring you the latest edition of A Fan's Notes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. It may not happen in this country very often, but so-called honor killings aren't exactly rare, and unfortunately, neither are other types of gender-based violence. Today we'll meet an attorney who helps women all over the world find safer places to live. Then we'll find out what two metro area ballot measures will mean for voters and for taxpayers. But first, there are some interesting statistical projections making the rounds in the state of Kansas today. Jeremy Hill directs the Center for Economic Development and Business Research at Wichita State University. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning.
You've been doing some projections of demographic trends in Kansas, and the news is not all that good. Do I have that right?
Well, it's not that good, but it actually hasn't shifted that much over time. So it's kind of like a glacier moving really slowly. It's something we should know about, but it is still not necessarily positive.
You have some information about folks who live in cities and rural areas. What have you found out?
All right. Well, when you look at the overall growth, we're seeing Kansas is going to grow about 0.4%, which is half the rate of that of the U.S., which is the same trend, and we're slowing into the future. When you look across Kansas, you see the MSA is growing the fastest, particularly Kansas City. You see a few smaller cities across the state doing pretty well, and then the rest of the state really declining. And it's a continuous decline into the future. Really, it's only 20 counties out of 105 that are expanding in Kansas.
Oh, say that again, 20 of 105 that are actually expanding?
Well, really our expectations of them to grow, we only have 20 of the counties expanding into the next 50 years out of 105.
What does that mean? What's your sense?
Well, I think this is not new news for most of the places. A lot of it's driven because of commodity issues. What's the bigger theme behind this? Well, if we're going to have this continuous change, I think this is going to affect future delivery of services across the state. It's going to affect tax structures at the state level and local levels, right? There's some longer-term implications that we continue to move forward as nothing's really changing and providing services, but I think we're going to have to come back and think about some of those in the longer context of the next 50 years and how to plan for them.
Jeremy, you may have mentioned it already, but tell us about the rural population of Kansas that so many folks are concerned about. What are you showing there?
So most of the rural areas declining, particularly in the working age population, that 18 to 64. And if you have a shrinking population in that segment, that's the big formation of households, having younger kids and buying new homes and spending. If you have a shrinking component there, it's going to put more of a burden on those communities going forward.
What does all this mean for the Kansas City area?
Well, for Kansas City, we have showed that as the strongest growth, right? The growth pole magnet is what we say, and there's some attraction of labor coming to that region, right? When you see having a growing market and you need more labor, and in the Midwest, we generally have a hard time attracting labor from the East Coast and West Coast, the value of this interrelationship across the state and Midwest is that where we don't need labor in some parts of the state, the Kansas City market is absorbing some of that. So it gives people opportunity to still stay within the area that they know and love and family structures, but they can go to more of a larger city and provide more opportunity and mobility in their career.
Jeremy Hill directs the Center for Economic Development and Business Research at Wichita State University. Jeremy, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Here's a number for you. 5,000 women and girls worldwide are murdered every year for a perceived dishonor to their families. That's right, 5,000. Here's another number. 30 million girls under the age of 15 worldwide are at risk today for female genital mutilation. I said, that's right, 30 million. Someone out there has to help these women and girls with visas or asylum when they flee gender-based violence in their home countries and wind up coming here. With us now is Kirsten Phelps. She's managing attorney of Taharay Justice Center in Washington that works on these issues. She once worked at the Kansas Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. And Kirsten, welcome back to your old stomping grounds. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, given the numbers I mentioned in the intro, I gather there's no shortage of business for folks like you these days.
There is not. And unfortunately, the demand and the need and the pleas for help are overwhelming, and there are not enough attorneys and individuals who can take these cases. Currently, Taharay, we are a national organization with three service offices in three cities across the country. And though we have a very efficient model that leverages pro bono attorneys from law firms and other volunteer partners, we still unfortunately have to turn away 5 out of 6 survivors who call us seeking help for their situation.
You're turning away 5 out of 6. How many attorneys do you have on staff?
Sure. In the greater DC office, we have currently 2 staff attorneys that handle immigration cases along with myself, as well as 1 family law attorney who can help abuse survivors that we're serving obtain divorce, custody, protective orders.
How many attorneys could you use?
You're
the managing partner here. If you could wave a magic wand, how many would you like to have?
I'm not sure there's a number until every survivor who's made the courageous step to reject the violence that she has faced from her partner, from her husband, her boyfriend, her family member, or her trafficker, we always need more.
I laugh, but I shouldn't, because every year, I guess, the demand is growing greater, which do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the demand is growing greater. There is, in some ways, that's a positive sign, because there are a lot of barriers for immigrant women and refugee women to know their rights in the United States. And though our clients come from all over the world, they all are here in the United States now. And a majority of our clients, whether they've experienced violence in their home country, have also experienced violence here in the United States. So empowering and helping immigrant survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, actually makes our community safer for everyone.
I was going to say, this notion that women don't have to take it, need not take it, is that message permeating even different countries in Africa, different countries in South America? Is the word getting out?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think what we do see is that societal change and culture change and community change really comes at a macro and a micro level. And true change in any community comes when the survivors from that community stand up and say, it's not enough. We see that with some communities in Africa when it comes to child and forced marriage currently. We've seen that with female genital mutilation or cutting in some communities. And we certainly see it with domestic violence and human trafficking throughout the world, because these are problems and epidemics worldwide, but they're also occurring here. So it's important for us all here in the United States, and whether we're citizens or immigrants, to stand up and say this isn't right.
I wanted to ask you about what you're saying about so much of that occurring here, but you've also said that so many of these women from other countries are coming here. Are we the primary destination, or do these women oftentimes go to European countries, or how does that shake out?
Sure. I think what we see is we see women who are fleeing for their lives because they are in danger of being killed by their partner, by their family members, or by gangs or other perpetrators of gender-based violence, are fleeing to where they believe they can be safe. And some have to go farther than others. We certainly are seeing a dramatic increase of women coming with their children, coming crossing the southern border pregnant and with small children right now, fleeing dramatic and epidemic levels of violence in Central America.
Yeah.
And we see a really strong demand and a need for services for these women who are in large part entitled and eligible for asylum under U.S. immigration law.
You know, these are women, you know, Kirsten, who are obviously desperate. They're coming from some of the most remote corners of the globe. And I'm wondering, how do they make their way here to begin with? How do they make their way to Tahereh to get the help they so desperately need?
Sure. Well, I'm always humbled and honored anytime a woman or a girl seeks our help and calls us to tell her story, because it's not difficult. It's not easy to talk about these things, and it's not easy to ask for help. And how women come to the United States, they come through a variety of channels, some more extreme than others. But where there is a will to save your life, and particularly your child's life, there is a way to find safety. Once they're in the United States, in our region, women who seek our services find out about us from a variety of ways. We do a lot of outreach and training to professionals in the community so that they are aware of the signs of domestic violence or of human trafficking and know where to turn for help. We get referrals from hospitals and courts and police, but we also get a lot of referrals from, frankly, from former clients who have gotten help from us, who have obtained status and humanitarian relief under the law, who have found independence and safety and stability in their lives after being served by Tahereh. And they are some of the best change makers out there, because they look at their coworkers, their friends, and they notice signs of domestic violence or abuse. And they say, you know, you don't have to put up with this. You don't. There are places you can turn for help, and Tahereh Justice Center is one of them.
And these women get here how, Kirsten? I mean, how do they even get out of their home countries? That just strikes me as so fraught with peril.
It is fraught with peril. It really depends on the individual circumstance. You know, certainly we see some women who have the means and the ability to obtain visas. They come here for school, or they come here on a tourist visa and they're able to find a way out. Others come by land, and they come and they have no other option but to pay somebody to help them get through. Some enter with visas, some enter without visas, are caught and then put into prison-like detention facilities with their children until they are able to convince immigration authorities that they have a credible fear that they'll be hurt or persecuted or killed if they return home.
How difficult of a task is that, what you just said, convincing immigration attorneys of what they're up against?
It's absolutely critical. You know, there's really an army, particularly of volunteer attorneys right now, that are going down to the border and working to provide pro bono assistance for these initial interviews with women and children in detention. Our Tahereh Justice Center, one of our service offices in Houston, and they do incredible work with women and children who are in family detention centers in Texas. Once somebody does establish that credible fear, however, that's only the first step to apply for asylum. It's not easy. It's a very difficult process. And what we know is that individuals who do not have an attorney who try to apply for asylum, even when their claim is very viable and strong, only have a 16% chance of winning asylum. If they have an attorney, that goes up to 46%. So having counsel is really the number one thing. And we're very proud to say that despite taking very difficult and protracted complex cases that others often deem unwinnable, at Tahereh, because of our expertise in working with trauma survivors and understanding domestic and sexual violence, as well as other forms of gender-based violence, we have a 99% litigation success rate on asylum claims.
We're talking this morning about women who are fleeing gender-based violence in their own countries, foreign countries to the U.S., and making their way here, and how they get help once they're here for legal services and that kind of thing. You know, one thing I wanted to point out, and you mentioned this earlier, Kirsten, is that your agency does a lot of work with American women fleeing violence. In fact, I think on your website it says 70% of your clients are fleeing gender-based violence that's occurred in this country. Should I be surprised?
I think that people are surprised, but they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
What we know is that domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence cuts across all communities. We particularly serve immigrant women and girls, but that does not mean that they are the exclusive survivors of that are experiencing these forms of harm, but they are facing additional barriers that other survivors may not face to seeking help. There are vulnerabilities involved when you are not a citizen of this country, when you perhaps do not speak the language, when you are afraid to reach out to law enforcement because you are afraid and you have been told that you are a criminal simply by being here, or that you have no rights in this country. And so what we do see is that a majority of our clients have experienced domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, and other forms of harm right here in the United States.
Put a face on some of the women that you work with here so we can begin to maybe humanize this story a little bit. Can you tell us about a case you've handled of late that might be of interest to our listeners?
Sure. I have many, many stories. If I could stay here all day, I could tell many. The women and children.
We got about 10 more minutes.
Yes, the women
and
children
get a big head here.
that I've worked with are truly incredible. And I think that it's important to know that these aren't also just stereotypes of women who come from what we might perceive as more violent communities or cultures. It's really global and an epidemic. I worked with a woman who gave up everything. She lived in Western Europe and had a great career. She fell in love with an American man, and she gave up everything to come here. He brought her here. They had a child together. And once they had a child together and were living in the United States, the husband became incredibly violent and isolated her. She wasn't allowed to drive. She wasn't allowed to leave the house. She wasn't allowed to have her own friends, even though she had a path to, you know, having work authorization and immigration status through her spouse. Her abuser refused to file papers for her as a way to control her and to keep her from asking for help. And she finally reached out for help when she couldn't take it anymore. And today she is on her way to opening her own small business.
Okay.
She has a green card. She's raising her U.S. citizen child who she has custody of, and she's doing wonderful. And we did that through existing U.S. immigration law.
I noticed that 15% of your clients come from sub-Saharan Africa. Tell us about someone from over there. Does anyone come to mind?
Sure, absolutely. I worked with an incredible woman who was one of the bravest, strongest women I've ever met in my life. We'll call her Miriam. She came from West Africa. She was incredibly intelligent. I think she speaks 6 or 7 languages. She was subjected to female genital cutting at 13 against her will, and she still suffers symptoms and complications from that today. And when she was a teenager, she assumed that she was going to be able to continue her education, but her very conservative uncles had arranged for her to be married to a man much older.
70 years old, I think, if it's the case I'm thinking about.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And she resisted and she refused and she tried to stand up for herself, and she engaged in all sorts of really creative and clever ways to try to avoid this happening. And some of her male relatives, in retaliation to try to force her into this marriage, locked her into a crop storage bin.
Wow.
For what we believe was 8 or 9 months.
8 or 9 months.
It had no bathroom, no windows. And the strength of her mother, actually, her mother helped break her out of it. She had been subjected to beatings by male relatives for months.
She being the mother?
No, the
woman who's being held.
The woman who's being held. Mm-hmm. And her mother was really her hero and eventually was able to break her out and get her to the embassy and to get a tourist visa so that she could get here. And it took about 3 years for her to get asylum. There are a lot of backlogs right now, and it took a very long time, and it was very painful for her to tell her own story, but she did, and we were able to apply for asylum and help her prepare her case. And today she is finishing college and going on to doing really incredible things.
You know, there are all these tools that you guys work with to help these women, and I'm thinking about asylum. There's Violence Against Women Act petitions, U visas, T visas, special immigrant juvenile status petitions. I'm not sure I know what any of these are exactly. Can you give us the nickel version of what some of these things are? What exactly is asylum, Kirsten?
Sure. Asylum is a form of humanitarian protection that means that the government of the United States will not force a person back to their home country if they've been persecuted on account of their race, religion, origin, national origin, or other protected ground.
How hard is it for women to approve that, to show that to an immigration attorney that that's what's going on?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to talk about what's happened.
There's skepticism there, I'm sure. Everyone's claiming that when they come here, probably.
There is some skepticism, and also gender. You know, being a woman is... in a country that does not respect women's rights and persecutes women is not enough. So
referring to this country?
To any country. So the asylum grounds, gender in and of itself is not a protected ground for seeking asylum. So we look at, have women expressed political opinions? Are they members of a group, you know, of viewed by society as unable to leave their abusers? There's a lot of intricate legal analysis that must be done. And it's very difficult for somebody without a competent attorney to do that.
What's a U visa?
Great. A U visa is a temporary visa that comes with work authorization for crime victims. So not just gender-based crime victims, but any serious violent crime victim who has cooperated with law enforcement and reported the crime against them here in the United States. If they cooperate with the investigation and prosecution, these are serious crimes like kidnapping, domestic violence, aggravated assault, then they may be eligible for these visas. There's only 10,000 given each year. And right now there's an incredible backlog. So by the time somebody reports to the police and goes through the entire process, they're still looking at waiting for potentially 5 to 7 years before they get that visa.
Is there a particular trick in protecting these women from a legal standpoint? What do you need to do to demonstrate that they should stay here?
I think the biggest thing is really understanding the law and that these legal protections exist for a reason, right? Congress passed and incorporated these into our laws because they represent our values as a society. And then it also really requires understanding the dynamics of gender-based violence, understanding the impact of trauma on a survivor to tell their story in a way that's meaningful and understandable by the system, and to have the patience and the skill to really be able to translate what an individual is telling you about the trauma they've endured and to put it into terms that the system will understand.
Do you have enough tools to work with, or does Congress need to give you more?
We could certainly use more U visas. We could certainly
There's
use...
There's a limit.
There is a limit, 10,000 a year. There's only 5,000 T visas for human trafficking victims each year. And we could certainly use more funding for training for legal aid and legal services, as well as for training and outreach and professional development for shelters, for law enforcement, for prosecutors, for everyone who interacts with a survivor of gender-based violence.
How long has the Tahereh Justice Center been around?
This next year will be our 20th anniversary.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Congratulations. And who started it?
Yeah. Our founder and executive director is a woman named Laylee Miller Monroe, who actually worked as a law student on the first gender-based asylum claim in the history of the United States. It was called Matter of Kasinga, and it was a case about female genital mutilation. And it was the first case where the highest immigration court in the United States established that gender may be a basis for seeking asylum in the United States.
You know, Tahereh is one of those words that's not spelled anything like it sounds. It's a terrifying word to talk show host, just so you know. What does it mean?
Sure. Our founder and executive director is a member of the Baha'i Faith and established our organization with Baha'i principles. And Tahereh was actually a 19th century Baha'i martyr and poet in Persia, who was really a martyr for women and stood up for women's rights.
Okay. Well, Kirsten Phelps will be giving the keynote address at the Activism for Human Rights From Issues to Action Conference here in Kansas City. It takes place all day Saturday at the UMKC Student Union on campus. You can register online at the UMK Central Ticket Office to get a seat there. Kirsten, thanks so much. Enjoyed having you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up, a couple of in-house debates about some big issues facing folks who live in the metro. We're going to talk about that idea on the ballot coming up next month about expanding and building a new Johnson County courthouse. And later on, Clay Chastain joins us to talk about light rail in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we learned how an increasing Latino population is impacting the Midwest. Also, how the Mocan rivalry is kept alive by basketball-playing grandmas. You heard that right. On Monday, the Smart Money experts return in studio. Well, Johnson County voters face a big decision next month. Should they vote for a quarter-cent increase in the sales tax for 10 years to pay for a new courthouse and coroner's facility? The total cost, about $200 million. The new courthouse would replace one built back in the 1950s. Here to give us the pros and cons of this proposal are Ed Eilert. He's chair of the Johnson County Commission. He favors this idea. Ed, welcome back. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Opposing it is County Commissioner Michael Ashcraft. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, and may I call you Steve?
Yes, you may.
Well, and a clarification, I have reservations. I wouldn't necessarily, I'm opposing the need for some improvements.
But you voted against it, putting it on the ballot, didn't you?
Well, I voted against it because of some procedural issues in terms of what was disclosed.
Okay.
We can get into that.
Okay, we'll get there. Ed Eilert, you're not known as a big proponent of tax increases, so why do you want to do this one?
Well, let's go back a few years. This is an issue. The courthouse issue has been on the Board of County Commissioners' radar screen for about 15 years and has been under discussion and review.
Yeah.
When I came on the commission in 2007, this was the first big project that was presented. It was a $300 million project. I was very skeptical at that time that we needed to proceed on that basis. And
because
since
then, too much money?
Well, $300 million, too large of a facility.
Okay.
So we have been continuing to work on identifying exactly what was needed. And the project has been scaled down. It's a $182 million project. There are significant deficiencies in the current structure. Aging infrastructure, 60-plus years old. We have security issues in the public hallway. Prisoners, victims, jurors.
Come face-to-face sometimes
face-to-face
or
in
close
those public
to
hallways.
Yeah.
That's been a long-time concern. We have ADA accessibility requirements that need to be met, and we only have two or three of our 23 courtrooms that have 21st century technology. So all of those issues need to be addressed. We can do that by building a new facility or spend more money renovating the existing facility.
You build the new facility, it would be built adjacent to the current courthouse, just sort of across the street, right, Ed? The
proposed new location would be immediately north across Santa Fe from the current courthouse, yes.
Okay. Michael Ashcraft, you said you had concerns, some reservations. Tell us about them.
Well, and one clarification, it's Ashcraft.
Ashcraft, that's
just
right.
Just so you know.
Ashcraft, John Ashcraft, too many years covering John Ashcraft, right?
Yeah, I appreciate being here, too, and what Chairman Eilert has offered, I think, is a valid perspective. And I think he makes some reasonable points, but I would suggest that there are other perspectives, and it basically boils down to what Johnson County is going to do with the resources that it has. Those resources in Johnson County are numerous. It's a very, very wealthy, very modern, very progressive community. But like any community, we have our limits. We just don't have unlimited resources. And when you look at the sales tax that's being proposed, the actual cost to taxpayers is going to be about $400 million. A couple hundred million for the courthouse, a little bit for the coroner's facility, another $150 million to the cities. The monies that go to the cities.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
Well, the monies that go to the cities, it just goes to the cities so that they can use as they wish. There's no accountability and no reporting. And, of course, we want to trust that those monies will be spent appropriately and needed things. But
I must interject. That is a requirement of the state statute.
I was going to say, you don't have any choice in that, right?
Every sales tax that the county has to be shared with the cities. That's a requirement of the legislation that was passed and the statutory requirements. So we have no choice. We must do that.
And what do the cities do with that money?
The cities obviously can expend that money at their choice. I do believe, however, it would be folly for anybody not to use this money for one-time capital expenditures, because the revenue will go away in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense that you would build an operating budget, ongoing costs, with a revenue source. They have public safety needs, whether it's a fire station, police station, those kind of activities, streets, roads, stormwater, all of those requirements could be at least partially met.
Michael Ashcraft, this idea of renovating the current courthouse, updating it instead of building a new one, does that make more sense to you?
Well, I think it's something that needs to be more seriously considered. Staff prepared a report a while back that said between $50 and $75 million was all that was needed for the next five through 2022 in order to address the immediate needs to making the building fully functional, which includes the ADA requirements, access. It's got issues related to upgrading the entries so people can get in and out easier. It has consideration for technology upgrades and other issues. So I look at that and go, that really should be a more serious consideration, because two things really drive my perspective. First, we did renovations a couple of years ago, and before we did that, the courthouse was experiencing about 600,000 visitors a year. Now it's down to 400,000.
Hmm.
Now, that's still a lot of people. It comes out to about 1,400 people a day. Now, mm-hmm. you compare that to, say, the Olathe Library downtown. They get about 1,600 people a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even the busiest point in downtown Olathe, which is actually the post office. And the other point actually has to do with filings. If you look at the court records, and you have to kind of sift through the web page on the courts, you'll notice that in the last 10 years, the actual number of filings, case filings in Johnson County, has gone from about 55,000 in 2006 to 42,000 in 2015.
Why is that'll surprise people?
I must interject here.
Yeah, go ahead.
The numbers are not correct that my colleague has presented. The cost of renovating the existing courthouse is estimated at $215 million. Just for the ADA requirements, it's about an $80 million number, because based upon a recent ADA study, mm-hmm. we have to make six courtrooms of the 23 fully accessible.
Mm-hmm.
That means you would have to remove about four existing courtrooms. So to keep the number of courtrooms at the same number, we would have to build another structure attached to the existing structure mm-hmm. of at least six to eight courtrooms to meet our 28-courtroom target.
Mm-hmm.
That pushes that number alone up close to $100 million when you include the interest costs. To renovate the courthouse, we have to keep the courthouse open for business every day. The renovation would have to occur in the evenings, nights, and weekends, and your labor costs go much, much higher. It's estimated at least 20% increase in labor costs
right.
to renovate.
Michael, respond to that.
Well, thank you, because I think Ed might want to look at those figures again, because if you look at the Clark Emerson Partners study, they said to bring us up to compliance on the courtrooms would be about $9 million. And if you add the owner's cost increase to actually implement this, staff said it would be about $13 million, which is a little bit different than what Commissioner Eilert...
But Commissioner, that does not include the loss of existing courtrooms and the necessity of building those courtrooms adding to the current facility.
Well, and see, that's a fair point.
You can't argue that it's only $13 million.
Mm-hmm.
$13 million would take care of the interior renovations, but you're requiring the building of additional courtrooms at about a $70 to $80 million number.
Michael?
Well, and that's a fair observation, but I also want to point out, through technology improvements in the last few years, we've actually reduced the number of people who work in that office, some 16 clerks, as well as with IT improvements, have eliminated all the paper filings, so we have that additional space. And we've moved the court trustee personnel and the sheriff's personnel out. So we have created additional space. So to say that we need to go from 25 courtrooms, which we currently now have, to 28 and spend $400 million is just a stretch for me. I just am challenged.
That space that was created has already been utilized.
Yeah, a couple other quick points. You also want to build a new coroner's facility. Why is that necessary?
The county has never had a coroner facility since the county was created. We use a private facility in another county. We pay fees.
In Wyandotte County, I think.
Wyandotte
right?
County. The facility is a metal building. It does not have 21st century technology to do toxicology and trace evidence analysis. We have to send it out. There are no ability to upgrade that facility. We are a customer. We have to pay fees.
Michael, give me a bottom line here. I need to wrap this segment up. So give our listeners some guidance here. How are you going to vote on this thing? Yes or no?
Well, I'm not going to really tell you how I'm going to vote. What I would really rather do is encourage people to look deeply past what is just the general information that's put out there and look deeply in terms of what this cost is going to be and whether or not you really think this is a priority for us. Because I would argue, my final argument is, if we want to spend $400 million, then why not put $100 million into mental health needs in the community and keep people out of the criminal justice system, and maybe another $100 million into IDD, intellectually and developmentally disabled, and that population, and let the taxpayer keep a couple hundred million dollars in their own pockets. So that's what I struggle with.
We're going to leave it right there. I want to thank
that analysis is out of bounds. It's not correct.
Because
this tax has to be spent on public safety facilities, and those activities do not qualify. If the commissioner wants to increase spending for mental health by $100 million, he would have to approve a property tax increase. Absent this sales tax, in order to renovate or take care of the needs of the existing facility, we would have to use property tax revenue.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Ed Eilert, who is chair of the Johnson County Commission, thank you. County Commissioner Michael Ashcraft, thank you very much, Michael, for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And finally today, a big vote on the Missouri side of the state line. Clay Chastain calls it his most ambitious light rail plan ever. It's a $2 billion, 40-mile system of light rail trains and electric buses. Kansas City voters next month will pass judgment on his plan to raise three sales taxes, totaling 3/4 cents for 25 years each, to construct this light rail and electric bus system from KCI to the Cerner campus in South Kansas City and from Union Station to the Truman Sports Complex. It's a big, bold plan that also happens to be intensely controversial. Joining me here this morning are Clay Chastain. He's a transit activist who has proposed numerous plans to city voters over the years. He joins us from his home in Virginia. Clay, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Also with us is an opponent of the plan, David Johnson. He's vice president of the Regional Transit Alliance. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Clay, I want to be really direct with you here. This is a $2 billion plan that would raise the sales tax by 3/4 of a cent. That's a pretty big bite of the apple here, and critics say it's just too much money for a city this size. What about it?
Well, the people didn't think so 10 years ago when we won the light rail election. This election's no different. It's going to be about Kansas City's future. What kind of city do the people want to live in? Light rail number three proposes a more green, prosperous, and transit-oriented city, as opposed to the more car-oriented, sprawling city we have now with the little new job growth and prosperity. So we can obviously afford to spend $1 billion on a new airport for the elite to fly in and out of, but why can't we spend money to build a modern public transportation system for the working man?
David, respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that Kansas City should be a more transit-oriented city, and I've been working for the last 10 years as well to further that goal. I think what Chastain's proposal does is it gives people sort of a fantasy plan that can't really be paid for with the money that's being collected. And the city's approval to put the plan on the ballot actually specified that, you know, they don't know that it could actually be constructed with the amount of revenue that would be generated.
And why is there a question there? I mean, Clay has put forward this plan and the taxes to fund it. The taxes don't completely fund it, in your view?
No. I mean, for 50 miles of light rail, you would probably have to estimate $100 million a mile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the streetcar, which is lower cost of implementation than light rail, was $50 million a mile. And so to think that someone could magic, and the city would have to construct this as well. So you're comparing apples to apples. The city is the constructor for streetcar, and they would be need to be the constructor for the light rail plan that's proposed. And to think that they could somehow cut the cost in half, or just reduce the cost from what they spent building streetcar is incorrect.
Clay Chastain, respond to that, and I should point out that part of your plan does rely on what you hope would be federal money coming into this plan.
Well, first of all, it's not a fantasy, and second of all, I don't think David is an engineer like I am, a degreed engineer, and nor has he studied transit for 15 years like I have. And second of all, what's a fantasy is building a streetcar system that runs in the streets, which traffic stops off and is not going to help low-income people get the jobs. It's for tourists, and that's what he's supporting, and I think the next logical step is to build a bigger, faster, more comprehensive citywide light rail system that will help the working man get to a job, drive widespread revitalization across the city, help the city grow in population, right, economic development growth. And as far as federal money, this plan meets all the criteria that the federal government requires for a light rail plan. First of all, we have a consensus from voters. We have a local tax dedicated. We're going to serve low-income people and people that really need a better transit system in Kansas City. It's going to be comprehensive, citywide. It's going to help the environment, reduce traffic. It's going to have a high ridership. So it meets all those requirements. And actually, it's going to help the bus system, too, because we're going to add $200 million in new electric minibuses to the bus system, as well as 40 miles of light rail. Because we've got a bus system now that it costs us $90 million a year to operate, and only about 6% of our people actually use it.
Mm-hmm.
It does nothing to grow and prosper the city. It tears up the streets. And all we do is keep adding more buses to it. That's a losing. When something's not working, you try something else. And something else, ballot question number three, to build a 40-mile light rail system.
Right.
That will be integrated in the bus system and help the bus system.
David, hop in here.
Yeah, let's talk about buses, because the plan proposed would take away $26 million a year from the ATA, which is doing a really great job covering the city with this critical service. And to take that away, albeit in 2024, is a major threat to what is the existing transit system. And to think that electric buses would have no less impact on city roads than a diesel bus is just also fantasy.
Clay, you do take about $26 million bucks a year from the buses. Why do you want to do that, Clay?
Well, we prefer not to if money was, you had a money tree in Kansas City, but we realize that giving the ATA bureaucracy $26 million more every year for a system that's not working, that's stupid. Keep putting money into a black hole that doesn't work. And furthermore, if we can use that money to leverage $1 billion from Washington and hire thousands of people to build this new light rail system, isn't that a great thing? And better value for that tax dollar than what we're using it for now? It's an abysmal value for the tax dollar. And furthermore, Steve, they told the voters in 2003, including me, I'm a Kansas City, Missouri registered voter, that that was a temporary tax to get the bus system's house in order. So they told a mistruth to the voters, and now they want this bus tax to go on for perpetuity, and we can better use it for a light rail and getting federal money in here so we can build a transit system that everyone can use in the entire city. Benefit from.
David, hop
so
in
two
here.
Things to respond to. Number one, the bus tax that's in question was intended to be a temporary tax in 2003. It lasted for 5 years. When the city went back to voters in 2008, it was not referenced as a temporary tax, and that is why it's now critical to the operations of that system. And to talk about Washington, they will not give you money for a system that takes away from bus funding. It's just it's well established, and the FTA has already issued some concerning statements about the plan.
Just briefly, Clay.
If you go to the federal government, let's say the city sent me to Washington. If they send me to Washington, I'll get $1 billion. Because you'll say, Washington, why do we want to keep sinking that sales tax into a bus system that only 6% of the serves 6% of the people, doesn't grow and prosper the city, it's not working. Other cities like Denver and Minneapolis are booming around their expanding light rail systems, and Kansas City's stuck plowing more money into buses, and it's not working. Why do we want to do that, federal government?
Okay.
Why don't we want to build a more balanced transit system that's useful to everybody and can drive widespread revitalization of the city around?
Clay, let me hop back in here. I want to get to one of the basic points of this, David. Why has the city moved away from light rail? I mean, this is what Clay Chastain is proposing. We've sort of gone the streetcar route here. How are they different, and why that direction?
So generally, they're the same.
Similar,
You know, you've got a rail vehicle, you know, running on tracks, and all of the prior light rail proposals, at least through the urban core, were to run on city streets. We don't have any underutilized rail that runs where people are and live and work in through the urban core, and so that's why all of those previous proposals ran essentially down Main Street or Troost. And so that's the difference with streetcar, though, is that you're using a smaller vehicle, you're spending less on the capital, and that's where the savings comes from.
You know, Clay, just one final point here. One thing you hear from residents here, and you've heard this a million times, you live in Virginia, and they don't think it's fair that you're here putting very costly proposals on the Kansas City ballot. What about that?
Well, number one, I've lived there for 20 years. I've been politically involved for the last 15. My whole family lives there. I want to move back to Kansas City. And that's really not the – Clay Chastain's not the point. The point is whether this is a good idea to move this city forward, and it is. And as far as the streetcars, listen, the streetcar plan or the expansion that David Johnson supports is not going to help a low-income person get to a job. We need better transit to help people that need transit, not a touristy frou-frou line for the elite to ride on and for drive some economic development.
Okay.
Nor are you ever going to ride a streetcar to the airport.
I got to leave our conversation there this morning. Clay Chastain's a transit activist who has proposed numerous plans to city voters over the years. Clay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Johnson is vice president of the Regional Transit Alliance. David, thanks to you as well.
And just for voters, it's question three, so
okay.
For that on the ballot.
Football season, baseball season, none is as seemingly endless as election season. This one has been particularly nasty, brutish, and long. And now, as Victor Wishna explains in a fan's notes, it's bullied its way into the sports headlines, too.
Let's face it, this is not exactly how Kansas City fans thought we'd be spending our October. The K is quiet. So is Arrowhead. The Chiefs didn't play this week, and, well, they didn't exactly play last week in Pittsburgh, either. Chiefs, Royals, even the Kansas City Moyles, that's my fantasy team, aren't providing much of a break from reality. And if there ever was a time we might want to be distracted, it is now. But if ever there was a time we shouldn't be distracted, it is now. The parallels between modern sports and politics are easy to draw, perhaps never more so than in this election. Both are media frenzies driven by the latest results and standings in the polls, with cavalcades of talking heads who spin and prognosticate. Sports fans and political junkies alike worship at the altar of 538, the website that made its reputation on accurate forecasts of winners and losers, both at the ballot box and on the field of play. By this past weekend, the course and discourse of this election cycle had sunk to a level unlike anything we'd seen in modern American politics, or sports, until one of the candidates drew a link. Of course, I'm talking about how presidential nominee Donald Trump dismissed his own braggadocious claims of sexual assault as locker room talk. People of all political stripes reacted with, well, maybe not shock, but certainly disgust, including those who make their livings in locker rooms. Prominent athletes from the NFL, NBA, and MLB responded with indignant interviews and a wave of tweets. "The guys I know and respect don't talk like that," Chiefs wide receiver Chris Conley wrote during Sunday night's nasty presidential debate. They talk about girls, but not like that. Period. The conversation was only beginning as the new hot topic became, well, the talk of the locker room. Others admitted that, sure, a certain lewdness is common, because it's a private place where the lowest common denominator thrives. In other words, it's talk and a mindset that can debase a room, not the other way around. Others pointed out that the case in question didn't even take place in a locker room, but on a bus with live mics and TV cameras. As comedian/fake journalist Trevor Noah put it best, if you conduct locker room talk everywhere, it's not the locker room, it's you. Of course, the problem is that there are too many who think this is what all men do, who don't understand that this isn't normal, or more to the point, that it shouldn't be. That's why it's heartening to see athletes and coaches and others speaking out. If that's the talk you hear around you, then be the place where change begins, Conley tweeted later, and to see hashtags like "not in my locker room" gaining traction. Of course, that's no match for what happened Friday night when author Kelly Oxford tweeted about the first time she was sexually assaulted at the age of 12 and invited others to share their own stories under the tag "Not Okay." More than 1 million women responded in just the first 2 days. Trump and his campaign have sparked a reckoning, exposing our society's fault lines by so unabashedly crossing them, not for the first time, and with 25 days to the election, probably not the last. There are still many distractions. I mean, Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce has that new dating show on the E! Network, right? And I firmly believe that our teams will turn it around and that the Royals will be back in the World Series next October. There's a lot to talk about. There's always next week. There's always next year. But some conversations can't wait.
Victor Wishna is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday, the Smart Money Experts return to the studio. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Lori Arbor, Ron Yerman, Michael Byers, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.